Hello, and welcome to Being Well. I'm Rick Hansen, a psychologist and author who studies how we can change our brains and our minds for the better. In this episode, we'll learn how the brain works and how our experiences leave lasting residues behind in the brain, for better or worse, and how we can use this understanding to teach the brain to become happier, calmer, stronger, and more loving. This recording was taken during my weekly meditation group. If you're not particularly spiritual or into meditation, no worries at all. Most of what I'm talking about is completely secular in nature. I start the presentation with a brief experiential practice designed to get you more in touch with a sense of underlying safety, which is so important to us. If you'd like to skip that part and jump ahead to my talk, move forward to the 6-minute mark. Okay, here we go. I want to create, first of all, a frame. But before I do that, though, I want to introduce this in an experiential way. So, like any experiential practice, see what happens for you when you do it, whether the experiential practice is trying to stay present with the stream of consciousness and not swept along by any part of it, and just simply doing what's called sometimes choiceless or open awareness, or other times when you try to cultivate something good inside yourself. You see what happens in both cases. Okay? So, In this practice, it'll be kind of, I'll do it twice with you. And I'll use this little practice, and then we'll talk about what's happening in your brain, applied to two different things. So here's the first one, for a minute or two. See if you can notice that you are already all right now. In other words, open to or bring into the foreground of attention, of awareness, what's already present in the mind, that there's enough air to breathe. Your body is signaling your brain continually, like a night watchman, all is well. When it is, sometimes it's not, but probably for most, if not everybody in the room, including me, right now you're basically all right. So try to locate the experience of all-rightness, basic all-rightness. You're surviving, you're living, there's enough air. Sometimes people experience this as you're not in excruciating pain, right? You're not in the moment of dying. You're actually, there's an ongoingness of being. So I'll be quiet for a moment as you try to open to or access, and sometimes can keep renewing this sense of basic, ongoing all-rightness. You're simply noticing what's already true. You're not trying to create an experience. You're already having this experience of enough air to breathe, of living, and you're moving this experience into the foreground of awareness. And as you can, for the next couple dozen seconds after I go quiet, see if you can protect this experience of ongoing all-rightness, stay with it, keep it going, and even help it pervade your mind so it grows inside you. So you sink into it as it sinks into you. Okay. So that was the first round. Let's try it again with something a little different. In this case, you're not going to just notice a positive experience you're already having. You're going to create one. All right? So if you can, bring to mind something that you feel glad about or grateful for. It's fine if it's more than one thing. Could be a place that you feel happy in, or friends, a pet, something that's good in your life, perhaps an important person. And as you think of one or more things that you feel glad about or grateful for, in this practice right now, you're helping that idea increasingly become an emotion of gladness or gratitude or happiness or well-being generally. You're allowing and encouraging the idea to become an experience. And then once you get that experience going, once you have it, help it grow inside your mind. Open to it, help it last, help it sink into your body. Really let it land inside you. It's okay to help yourself be happy. Okay, so come on back. That was the second little experiment. All right. I want to explore more of a frame for this whole topic. And in this frame, the question is, what was happening when you were doing that? In the first case, when you were noticing, you know, a positive experience that was already present, probably in the background of awareness that you brought forward, and then you sort of marinated in it, right? And then in the second practice, you deliberately activated, based on my suggestion, you know, think of one or more things you're grateful for or glad about, you activated a positive mental state, in effect, an experience, and then you also kind of marinated in it. You took in that good. You helped it register. You helped it land in yourself. You stayed with it. You prolonged that experience, and you brought your body into it. You felt it in your body. It became emotional and rich, right? Not merely conceptual. So in our experience, all we're aware of is thoughts, feelings, sights, sounds, tastes, touches, and smells, right? We never have any direct contact with our own brain. On the other hand, scientists are increasingly clear that those experiences that you had just there, in the last 5 minutes, were based on changes in underlying neural activity. So how do we take this into account when most of the world's wisdom traditions, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, the shamanic traditions of the world, most of the world's humanistic traditions, secular philosophical traditions, folklore, the Iliad, the Odyssey, you know, Aesop's Fables, Shakespeare, Dickens. Who else? Susanna, or like, who wrote, I don't know, pill popping, whatever, you know, like, what's his name? The guy who writes the thriller, Stephen King, there we go. You know, all the great literature of the world, whatever. You know, the people who did this generally had no idea about underlying biology or evolution or nature. And yet we today, now, you know, in 2013, 21st century, are learning more and more about the underlying natural processes that are the basis of, or minimally co-arise with, our own experiences. What shall we do with that knowledge? What's a frame of reference here that respects both ancient wisdom traditions and psychology in general, respects it, isn't reductionistic about it, yet, on the other hand, takes into account life itself? In other words, how can we ground mind in life? So I want to create kind of a frame about that. Other than a hypothetical X factor, okay? So I'm drawing a square with my fingers if you're just listening to this. Other than a hypothetical X factor of God or the transcendental, the spirit, the ground, the nameless, other than that, we're left with entirely natural causes underlying mental activity. Our thoughts, our feelings, our hopes, our dreams, our sorrows, the sound of the bell, the taste of cinnamon, must all be fundamentally a natural process, grounded in nature. What else is it? If we acknowledge and set aside the transcendental, the supernatural, we're left with natural explanations for our thoughts, our feelings, our suffering, our craving, and our freedom. Historically, there have been many examples of extraordinary phenomena, seemingly extraordinary phenomena, that originally are described in terms of supernatural causes, like lightning, or the changes of the seasons, or the diversity of species, animal species, plant species, the diversity of life. There are many, many examples of seemingly extraordinary phenomena being brought into the natural frame. We now understand that lightning is not because Jupiter, Zeus, is mad, right, and blasting things, but in fact is based on electrical charges, essentially, between the earth and the clouds above. We know that the changes of the seasons are not due to God moving the heavens around the earth, or even pushing the earth around the sun with his finger or her finger, right? But in fact are due to the laws of gravity, or even more deeply and amazingly, due to the way that the mass of the sun bends space-time, so the earth goes around the sun like a marble rotating around a sink. That's pretty wild. And we now understand that all the different species that are on the planet, you know, roses, bananas, we share about 20% of our DNA with bananas, as I find that a humbling and kind of grounding thought, right? The fish swimming around in this little pond we have in our backyard, the raccoons at night that try to get them, and good on the fish, fail routinely. I'm happy about that. All of that, our cat, you may have pets, the whole diversity of species is based on a 3.5 billion year natural process of evolution. So this overall process of bringing seemingly extraordinary phenomena into the frame of ordinary causes and conditions is called naturalizing. So in a Buddhist frame, what might it mean to naturalize the Dharma? Or more broadly, for any kind of psychological or spiritual practice, what might it mean to naturalize it? And how can we do that in a middle way? That on the one hand is not resistant to grounding mind in life, and on the other hand, does not just reduce mind to life. How can we understand our thoughts, our feelings, our upsets, our anger, our fears, our joys, our love? How can we understand that in a natural frame and make use of that natural frame to help ourselves and others suffer less? That's the larger frame here. So I want to read you a little quote here from Eric Kandel, who won the Nobel Prize for showing how deep down in the mechanics of the nervous system learns from its experiences. All right? He says, "All cells have specialized functions. Brain cells have particular ways of processing information and communicating with each other. Nerve cells form complete circuits that carry and transform information. Electrical signaling represents the language of mind, the means whereby nerve cells, the building blocks of the brain, communicate with one another over great distances. Nerve cells generate electricity as a means of producing messages. All animals have some form of mental life that reflects the architecture of their nervous system." Okay? So in that frame, and this, by the way, if we survive the next 5 minutes, it will be downhill, I'm happy to say, because I'm going to kind of lay out the framework that's used in neuropsychology generally, and I'll use myself, for talking about the relationship between not physical, immaterial, mental activity and the underlying physical neural activity that is a condition for mental activity. All right? So you hold on your seatbelt. Here we go. So, what Kandel is talking about is the nervous system as an information processing system. You could think of DNA molecules as information processors. That's not in the nervous system. That's more genetic. You could even think of the immune system, particularly the second, more recent branch of the immune system that has to do with acquired immunities, as also an information processing system. So what is information? Right? Information is not physical. Information is a signal, a meaning, an instruction, a program, a piece of data. We're surrounded with information. We're like the fish that swim in the sea, and we don't realize that, you know, we're wet. For example, the physical sounds in the air right now represent information. Our daughter right now is in Georgia teaching English, not the state, the country. All right. And so in Georgia, like they make sounds, she has no idea what the meaning is of those sounds. So you can see that meaning is in some sense distinct from the physical substrate that represents it. If you drove here and encountered a traffic light, the red, yellow, and green of the traffic light, since E equals MC squared, energy is mass and so forth, materiality is one unified thing, the red, the yellow, the green is material. Okay? But the meaning of red, stop. The meaning of green, go. Which could be reversed, by the way. It's arbitrary. The meaning is not physical. You can't weigh a meaning. A computer, right? Physical hard drive represents not physical information. The song, the picture, the Word document, the email, the programs themselves. See, the basic idea, it kind of sounds weird, but you realize we're surrounded with examples where we're dealing with this not physical information that's represented by or stored in or communicated through some underlying physical substrate. Because without that physical substrate, whether it's the chalkboard that has letters written on it, right, or the airwaves that are representing the meanings of my words, or the light, the traffic light itself, without that physical substrate, inside the natural frame, you cannot represent information. So we have a nervous system that evolved originally to help sensory systems of, you know, animals 600 million years ago communicate with their motor systems. Hey, this smells good. Swim toward it. Right? And if it smells better and better, eat it. Right? Or, right? Or, ooh, hurt, 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 get away. Whee! Okay? Well, those signals are information. And they're conveyed in the evolving nervous system. That's its function. The nervous system's job is to process, store, operate upon, and communicate, and receive information. That's what the word mind means in neuropsychology. It's not capital M mind, it's just everyday mind. It's mental. Mental equals information processing. That's the standard view. That's the view I'm, the messenger of right now. Okay? In the standard view then, we have thoughts, we have feelings. A moment ago, you were in touch with body sensations maybe of well-being or happiness or gladness or gratitude. The tip of the iceberg of information processing in the nervous system is our experience. Our conscious experience is only a tiny fraction of all the information in our nervous system. All right? We privilege it because it's what we know, but it's a tiny fraction of what's there. Okay? Now, it's still a great mystery how the physical nervous system produces our conscious experience. But inside the natural frame, it's presumed that it must. We don't know how we experience the color red or the taste of an orange, but it's presumed that the nervous system must be doing this. Otherwise, we're left with supernatural explanations. So to summarize and hopefully survive the last 5 minutes and then open up for discussion and then talk about how to use this in practical ways, because that's really our focus here. Okay? We have mental activity, some of which is unconscious, some of which is conscious, that requires underlying neural activity. So when you had the experience of gratitude, or when you tuned in and notice that you're actually all right now, that was mental activity. mental activity required, it entails underlying neural activity inside the natural frame. There's a one-to-one mapping in the natural frame of all mental activity to underlying neural activity. And, remarkably, repeated patterns of neural activity representing repeated patterns of mental activity, repeated patterns of neural activity change neural structure. That means that the brain is changed. The nervous system is changed by our experiences, especially repeated, especially intense, and, as I'll get to, alas, especially negative experiences. That's the negativity bias of the brain and the nervous system. So this is the basic model. Now, the Buddha, to use a traditional terminology of nama and rupa, nama being consciousness, mental activity, rupa being form, rupa's materiality. All the Buddha knew, and other great teachers like Muhammad, Moses, Jesus, others known and unknown throughout history, all they knew was nama. All they knew was consciousness. But now, through tens of thousands of studies, most of which are on animals, I'm reporting that. I'm myself concerned about animal research. You may have heard me say that if all the species on the planet got one vote, we'd be gone the next day, right? I think dogs would vote for us, cats. They'd have to think about it, but they'd come through, I think. You know. So that said, there's an incredible amount of research on this that shows very, very tightly correlations between all kinds of mental activity and necessary underlying neural activity. All right? So now we know that we know objectively. We don't experience it. We see it with our microscopes. We look at an MRI. We see what happens when the nervous system is damaged. We see what happens when the nervous system is strengthened, right? We see objectively that underneath our experience of consciousness, of nama, is this underlying physical process that continually maps to it. You know, the metaphor for me about this is mercury. You know, the metal. So imagine bobbing up and down in a sea of mercury, all right? And it's mirror-like. Above the mercury, all we know is nama. All we know is consciousness, our own phenomenology, sights, sounds, tastes, touches, smells, and thoughts, broadly defined, right? But it's as if the mercury is right here. And now, 2,500 years after the Buddha taught and walked the dusty roads in northern India, we actually know that what's happening above, you know, the mercury line, as it were, is based on underlying physical processes. And we also know that what we do up here at the mental level often has causal power of its own. It actually, if you imagine the logic of a conversation with a friend, or more formally, working your way through one of those proofs in geometry. One of my favorite things actually were geometry proofs. When our son was in high school with geometry, I'd be like, oh, I want to help you with that. You know, that's a lot of fun. But that's weird. But if you just imagine the logic of anything, it takes on a life of its own. There are large parts of the brain, they're called association cortices. They're like RAM, R-A-M, random access memory in a computer. Or, if you will, the whiteboard up here, they can represent anything. So the logic of the information that's flowing, you know, the feelings back and forth with a friend, thinking about the best way to write an email, working through how you think about something, and so forth, that has a causal power of its own. The causal power of the unfolding of thought, right, hijacks or incorporates or co-opts underlying patterns of neural activity to represent it, which then change neural structure, which then conditions thought in a circular kind of way. So, last word on philosophy here, then I'll see what you think. This overall model, in case you have any interest in going back into Wikipedia to check it out, is called dual aspect monism. Isn't that a mouthful? I avoided philosophy in college because I thought it was too hard. I think I'm right. But anyway, dual aspect. So we have immaterial flows of information. They're immaterial. They're not physical. They're categorically distinct from the underlying physical substrates that represent them, whether it's in the nervous system or in a traffic light or in a computer hard drive, right? But they co-arise to make our life. They co-arise together. Two aspects, distinct, categorically different, dualistically different, yet at a higher level of organization, they're two integrated aspects of a single system, the mind-brain system. That's the framework. That's the natural frame. It's okay to disagree with it or to think that it's not useful, whatever, but it's fundamentally the frame of reference for doing this here. And the takeaway is, if we start to understand more deeply what's actually happening inside the black box, right, of the brain, inside, below the mirror of down there in rupa, right, down there in form, we can then start using targeted mental activity to deliberately stimulate and therefore strengthen the underlying neural substrates of wholesome states of mind, wholesome factors of mind. Or to put it in a certain kind of language, we can increasingly skillfully have or activate useful feelings, inclinations, perspectives, desires, behaviors, emotions, moods. We can deliberately activate those. And then once activated, since repeated patterns of neural activity create changes in neural structure, through repeatedly activating these useful states of mind, we can gradually change our own brains for the better. And that's the promise, really, of, you could call it experience or self-directed neuroplasticity, or, you know, in a Buddhist framework, I think of it as neurobhavana. Cultivation is bhavana. Okay. So that was the headiest stuff I'm ever going to do. And it's over. Phew. The drilling has stopped. All right? So let me just get ready to turn off the recorder for a moment here. And then we'll see what you think about this. So what do you think about this? Any comments or questions? Bear with me so far. So what role does the amygdala play in the bobbing, as it were, or the changing of our brain? Well, you know, the amygdala is the alarm bell of the brain. There are two of them. There's one on each side. Its basic function is to track what in Buddhism is called the feeling tone of experience, or in Western psychology, the hedonic tone of things being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And if you know the model of the mind that the Buddha came up with, the feeling tone of experience is really important. This hedonic tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, because it's continually arising. You can't do anything about it in the moment. Drop a brick on your foot, unpleasant. Put a chocolate truffle in your mouth, pleasant, right? Have someone frown at you across a dinner table, we're social animals, unpleasant. Have someone smile at you across a dinner table, pleasant, right? That's continually moving through the mind. Liking, disliking, pleasant, unpleasant, right? But what happens is that the amygdala tracks it, and if it's significantly pleasant, and especially if it's at all unpleasant, the amygdala sends out a signal. Pay attention. This is important. It's like a salience detector, in a way. This matters. This is relevant. You know, you need to know about this, right? And then that creates this whole cascade that changes the structure in the brain. The trick, of course, over time, is to tolerate pleasant or unpleasant, liking and disliking, without tipping into, you know, wanting, gotta get it, or wanting, push away, fight, you know. And so that would be a very quick summary for a quick question. But where I really want to invite you here is to contemplate, what is it like to be a body? You know, since we don't experience the body ever directly, we tend to live in the nama realm. You know, and I'm basically inviting you to come into a consideration, like, wow, the thoughts I'm having, the sound of Rick's voice, the meanings right now, are entirely a physical production within the natural frame. By the way, I'm a transcendentalist. I think there really is an X factor woven into the nature of things. That said, I'm going to stay inside the natural frame now, because mostly, if not entirely, right? If there's no transcendental entirely, If there is a transcendental, mostly what you're hearing right now, the feeling of the chair against you, right? The warmth you have in your heart for people around you, you know, your own good intentions, that is a production of the meat. What's it like to own that? That it's the meat that's doing it. It's that we are animals. It's an animal process conditioned by 600 million years of the evolution of the nervous system, 3.5 billion years of the evolution of life altogether. What happens when you come home to this idea that you have a really fragile brain? It's continually changing its structure based on what flows through your mind. And you have the opportunity to change its structure for the better. Like, what happens when that really starts sinking in? Yeah. So what's the promise of meditation? Well, meditation, like any form of mental training, including Pilates or yoga or psychotherapy or mindfulness practice in general, or gratitude practice or making art, you know, or loving your children or loving your friends, loving the whole earth. Any kind of practice that's repeated will change your brain. What's useful, and increasingly I want to get into in, you know, future weeks, the usefulness piece of this, what's useful is to use what we're learning about the animal, the body that we are, in a very intimate way, to actually strengthen our practice, whether it's for meditation, or being resilient at work, or being determined, or sustaining your sobriety. You know, how can we use what we're learning about the animal that we are? I know for myself, when I really, it's very interesting for me that this fairly intellectualized journey has taken me so deeply back into my own body. It's really a coming home to the body and a kind of sweetness for the animal that we each are that comes a lot out of a respect for its vulnerability. You know, I'll get into the ways that the brain and the body are very easily affected by negative experiences, right? But also, there's a kind of caretaking or a sort of, you know, being a friend to yourself that you actually can, through what you rest your mind upon routinely, really, really change your brain for the better. One of the takeaways from this is that practice bears fruit. It really does change us physically. But it's funny to me often that, you know, whether it's in psychology or in contemplative practice that's very much about body sensations, there's this tendency to live entirely up in nama and not really take into account the implications of being a body, to really take into account what it means to ground mind in life. Or putting it a certain way, what's it like to ground mind-ing in live-ing?
So that marks the end of my talk on using the mind to change the brain. Any kind of practice, when repeated enough, will change your brain over time. The key is, of course, to make sure that we're internalizing and growing positive habits, positive material, rather than negative ones. As always, thank you for supporting this podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing or leaving a positive rating. Until next time, I'm Rick Hansen, and be well.